And let's hear next about a man who never got to see his life's work completed. Charles Babbage is considered by many to be the father of modern computing. And now a 5-ton computing engine built more than 120 years after his death is on display at the Computer History Museum in California's Silicon Valley. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Babbage's massive engine stands taller than most men and fills half a gallery. Its 8,000 parts of cast iron, steel, and bronze fit together in a tight weave. But you can't just plug in this engine. It's powered by hand crank.
It absolutely is a good workout.
Tim Robinson is a docent here at the museum who recently retired from a career in computer systems. As he turns the crank, the parts move in synchronicity. Wheels with numbers align to make perfect calculations.
What's this? Special about it is it's the first automatic calculating machine. That is a machine in which you set it up to solve a particular problem. Its operation is entirely automatic. As long as you keep turning that crank, it will produce new results.
And most importantly, accurate results that are pressed into a mold to make printing plates for books. Babbage was a citizen of Victorian England, a nation that relied on its navy to maintain its vast empire. The books were filled with mathematic calculations necessary for navigation.
And if the tables had an error, you get the wrong answer. A ship could either get lost or run aground, so lives and property were thought to be at stake.
The story goes that one day Babbage, a mathematician, came across so many errors in a book, he exclaimed, "I wish to God these calculations had been executed by steam." He was inspired to design his difference engine. He got money from the British government, but after 10 years of work, the government wouldn't give him more.
He was so far ahead of his time in his thinking that many people opposed what he was trying to do on the grounds that they just didn't understand.
Babbage's unfinished engine was turned to scrap metal, leaving nothing but his drafts and drawings. He remained largely an inspirational figure. No one was sure his engine would have worked. And then, in the 1980s, Dr. Doran Swade, then a curator at the Science Museum in London, started reading about him.
And when I got to the point where it said Babbage failed because of limitations of Victorian engineering, I sort of quickly flipped ahead to say, well, okay, did the engine work when they did build it, when these limitations no longer applied? And was staggered to discover that nobody had actually ever tried.
But Swade tried. It took Swade and his collaborators 17 years. They used only materials that would have been available to Babbage in his time. They built two engines. One is on display at the Science Museum in London. The other is here at the Computer History Museum. It was flown to California, 5 tons, remember, on a 747. The museum's Tim Robinson.
I think now he is recognized as a true genius. If the rest of the world had appreciated the significance of what he was trying to achieve, things might have turned out differently.
Differently, because if Babbage had actually completed his engine, he might have had the support to build what historians consider to be his greatest design, the analytic engine, which shares many features with early computers.
It would have been programmed on punch cards, the kind of cards that were being used at that time to automate weaving looms.
Babbage also inspired the woman who many now call the mother of computer programming, Ada Lovelace. Lovelace, the daughter of the poet Lord Byron, met Babbage during one of his London soirees. She helped Babbage put his ideas in writing, and she often understood the implications of his work better than he did.
Now I'm dreaming of an engine like Babbage's.
Tilda Swinton played Ada Lovelace in this 1997 film, Conceiving Ada.
That will one day allow us to predict an infinite series of numerical outcomes. And that could immediately be put to all sorts of practical uses.
The Computer History Museum's Tim Robinson.
Ada recognized that you could actually use numbers to represent things other than just quantity. They could represent letters of the alphabet, they could represent musical notes, they could represent positions on a chessboard. And so she speculated what might be achieved. And, you know, thinking about computer chess in the 1840s is kind of way out there, right?
Even today, when Dr. Doran Swade turns the crank of Babbage's bronze and steel engine in London, people are amazed when they see it work.
I still never fail to receive huge pleasure from watching people's reaction when they first see this extraordinary spectacle. Their jaws literally drop.
Swade believes if Babbage had completed the difference engine in his time, it might have inspired a Victorian information age. Instead, he died an embittered old man with a tarnished reputation. The Difference Engine at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, will be on display through the end of next year. Then it goes to Seattle, where it will become part of a private collection. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
Even if you can't make it to the Computer History Museum in time, you can see an amazing video of Charles Babbage's 5-ton engine in action at our website, npr.org. Now, some businesses receive tax credits to support the research and development of new products, and advocates say this subsidy creates jobs. Legislation that just passed in the House would extend the tax credits for another year, and many high-tech and pharmaceutical companies want the credit to be made permanent. For member station KUNC, Kirk Sigler reports.
Consider this paradigm. Research and development drives innovation, which creates new products, which are then sold, boosting the economy. Or at least that's the pitch made by people like Karen Myers. She's vice president of CA, a computer software company that relies on the federal tax breaks.
We feel a real sense of urgency because we understand that the clock is moving.
Thousands of workers from R&D companies sent a letter to Congress urging them to extend the credit. It's slated to expire at the end of the month. President Obama has called for its extension at least through next year. But Monica McGuire of the National Association of Manufacturers wants the credit to be permanent.
Companies need continuity to know that the credit's going to exist at the time the R&D project is completed. I mean, in manufacturing, a typical R&D project will span 5 to 10 years.
McGuire calls the R&D credit a jobs credit, noting that most of the money saved goes to pay company employees. Manufacturing has shed more than 2 million jobs since the recession started. Still, even in a tough economy, the credit's extension is a thorn for deficit hawks. The measure now heads to the Senate, where debate on a health care overhaul could stall any action before the credit expires. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler in Denver.
Everyone knows that Santa Claus is getting ready for his annual Christmas delivery of presents to good little boys and girls around the world. But how does he get it all done? In the next few minutes, spoiler alert, we'll reveal some of the high-tech tools Santa uses to tackle this monumental challenge. Here to explain is Gregory Moe. He's an editor at Popular Science magazine and is now out with a book of Santa science: The Truth About Santa, Wormholes, Robots, and What Really Happens on Christmas Eve. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
One of the ways you begin this book is talking about an interesting idea from the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke. And I'll quote here, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." And that certainly applies to Santa Claus in a way.
Exactly. I think part of the reason people look at Santa and say it's all magic and some older kids start to lose their belief in Santa is that his job does seem impossible, this notion of getting around the world and visiting all these homes in a single night. But the reason he can do it is that he has incredibly advanced technology. Santa's tools and his toys are effectively a few hundred years beyond anything that we have here at our disposal. And as a result, it does seem like magic. But it's really all science and technology.
Well, we can't get to everything that you have in the book, but let's begin with something that we all know about, the red suit. Now, looks cozy, but I gather it's more than a fashion statement in those sub-zero North Pole temperatures that Santa spends most of his time in.
Absolutely. Santa's suit, it looks like just sort of almost a snuggie, wearable blanket, but in fact, it's tuned for extreme conditions and also extreme instances where he might need to become, say, invisible. Santa's suit is laden with what are called metamaterials, which have this effect of bending light around a person so that they turn invisible. It's something like Harry Potter's invisibility cloak, for example.
Hmm. Now, Santa always seems to have reading glasses perched on his nose. Whenever you see him portrayed in it, you know, up there in the North Pole, indoors, you know, as if maybe he's reading children's letters. They are special, though, those glasses.
Absolutely. They're very special in it. And it is kind of a quaint, cute image. But in fact, these glasses have what's called a heads-up display, where when Santa looks through those lenses, he sees a whole range of information, both about the house he's visiting, the presents he's supposed to leave, the residents, including, you know, the children and whether they've been naughty or nice. And it also allows him to figure out where he's going next and how to get there. It's almost like a GPS map that we have in our car.
Right, but so much more than that.
So much more. And scientists are developing some technology like this today, but they're not quite at Santa's level.
Now, there's something that surprised me, but it actually makes perfect sense, and that's that he has a special device to make sure that he doesn't deliver gifts that are already under the tree. I mean, maybe something Mom and Dad bought. Last thing you'd want is to double up on, you know, G.I. Joe or something like that.
Exactly. Now, Santa knows what we want, but he doesn't really know what presents to leave for a given kid until he gets to that house and looks under the tree. The issue here is that a lot of these presents are wrapped, and Santa doesn't have the time to unwrap every present and rewrap it to see what's inside. So he has a very advanced scanner that uses terahertz wave radiation to see through the wrapping and the cardboard and make out the shape inside. This vital information is then sent back to the North Pole. It's processed, and Santa receives a message saying, okay, this child has received this transformer or that doll, and he knows that he's supposed to leave something else.
And this is technology that exists.
Right. Well, I spoke with a researcher in terahertz radiation myself. These are scanners that scientists are working on. Jason Dickinson at the University of Massachusetts helped to imagine how Santa's scanner itself might work, because the truth is I don't have all the information about how Santa's operation works.
Hopefully we won't ruin anything by going through a few more of these. There's the sleigh. This is most interesting. He seems to be taking advantage of some technology that didn't really exist back when Santa began and doesn't depend as he has traditionally on reindeer.
Right. Well, Santa's sleigh has what's called warp drive, which instead of allowing him to get from point A to point B faster, it actually brings point B closer to point A. So it shrinks the space between the house he's leaving and the destination home. The reindeer are still helpful here, but he doesn't really require them for flying anymore.
So they're just cruising along.
Right, exactly. Well, I spoke to an astrophysicist at the University of Berkeley, Richard Mueller, and he suggested that, in fact, reindeer may not be able to fly. They might just be really good leapers. And what we're seeing when we think we see a reindeer flying off a rooftop is the reindeer jumping off, bringing the sleigh with them into the air, and then the whole set, the reindeer, Santa, his sleigh, all of it, disappearing into a warp bubble created by one of these warp drive engines.
A warp bubble. Is there a quick explanation of that?
Well, Santa's warp drive engine, it bends space and twists space-time in such a way that it can shorten the distance between two points. It's sort of like leaving the known visible universe and slipping back in again at a different point.
It is not just technology that you're talking about here. You're also talking about a different sort of science, a sort of social science. Child psychology, apparently, thanks to Mrs. Claus, has entered into Santa's thinking.
Right. Well, this notion of kids being either naughty or nice and Santa leaving coal and if they've been bad and sort of ruining their Christmas doesn't entirely work. You know, Mrs. Claus has been reading this kind of research in child psychology for years, and she made the point with Santa that positive reinforcement does work really well. So what Santa tries to do these days is, instead of highlighting negative behavior, he sees if a kid who's been behaving badly does something very nice, and he captures these sort of things through all of his surveillance devices, which are all around the world. Santa tries to highlight that and give this kid a present and encourage them and say, you know, hey, thanks for picking up little Billy off the playground the other day instead of pushing him and things like that. And because, you know, Santa's knows he wants to have a positive effect on these children. And so when Mrs. Claus came to him with all this research and said, look, Santa, we need to change our ways, he was absolutely open to it.
Science writer Gregory Mohn is author of the new book, The Truth About Santa, Wormholes, Robots, and What Really Happens on Christmas Eve. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for
this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This past decade has featured dramatic changes in the ways we listen to and make music. One major transformation is how we record music. Recording technology has become much more affordable, so bands no longer need to book hours of costly studio time in a facility with millions of dollars of equipment. They can simply record on a laptop. So, where does that leave professional recording studios? Joel Rose has that story.
New York City used to be home to dozens of high-end recording studios, none more famous than the aptly named Hit Factory.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. Batman sitting on a little stool takes money from my hand while his eyes take a walk all over you.
I'm standing outside the Hit Factory on West 54th Street in Manhattan. In the lobby of the building, you can still see platinum records by Paul Simon, Bruce Springsteen, and Michael Jackson. But the building is no longer a recording studio. It's condos, starting at just over $1 million each.
This whole area in New York City was filled with recording studios that were busy all the time.
Jim Anderson is a longtime recording engineer and NPR alum who now teaches at New York University.
I could start counting off, I don't know, how many recording studios that were within a 10-block area. Media Recording, Hit Factory, Sony Studios, A&R Recording.
Anderson says digital technology has gotten a lot better over the last 10 years to the point where you can make an almost professional quality recording on your laptop for a fraction of what you'd spend in professional studios.
They lost a lot of work that was coming in maybe on demos or on spec. All of that little work just drifted away.
All that little work can now be done in a home studio. If that was the only problem, larger studios might have been able to get by. But some of the big work dried up too, as the major record labels slashed their budgets. Add the soaring price of real estate, and it's easy to see why most of the well-known Manhattan studios closed their doors. But there are still a few in business. Gabriel Alegria and his Afro-Peruvian sextet are mixing an album around the block from the old Hit Factory at Avatar Studios. It's one of the last recording facilities in town big enough to accommodate a full orchestra. General manager Tino Passante insists Avatar offers something you just can't get from a computer in your bedroom.
You can never replicate the sound of a room unless you have a room. And you can hear it missing in records that are not done in the studio. I mean, yeah, you can make a record at home, but that doesn't mean you should.
It's not just big New York studios that are feeling squeezed. Even in Philadelphia, where the rent is a lot cheaper, the past decade has been a struggle for many studios.
So I've been sort of pecking away at this a little bit. It's just the instrumental track so far.
Engineer Brian McTeer runs Minor Street Recordings. He's been working with indie rock bands in Philadelphia since the 1990s, and business was good until the credit crunch of 2008.
All of a sudden, we were stuck. I had nobody that could pay me anymore. And everyone wanted to pay me. Everyone wanted to make these records. I just had to go the extra distance of helping them figure out where they would get money from.
Sometimes that meant showing bands how to appeal directly to their fans online to raise money for the recording. Then, earlier this year, McTeer launched the Weather Vane Music Organization. It's a nonprofit that helps artists record one song in his studio for free, while Weather Vane documents the project on video.
Hey, guys. A little slow.
One, two. One, two.
This is from one of four sessions so far by the Philadelphia band BC Camplight. Frontman Brian Cristinzio says it would be cheaper to record at home, but that's not the sound he's going for.
I refuse to make a record that I know could be better. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. It's like, why would I do something that I know could be better if I just had the money? So that's where I am now, and probably where I'll be when I'm 70.
Cristinzio has made two records, and he's ready to start his third, but he says his label can't afford to pay for it. Engineer Brian McTeer hopes to help musicians in Cristinzio's situation through his Weather Vane organization, and that it'll attract enough attention to become economically self-sustaining. It has projects planned next year with 10 artists, including singer and songwriter Sufjan Stevens. McTeer hopes musicians see the value of studios like his.
The real value for most bands isn't the equipment. I mean, a guy at Guitar Center or Sam Ash would like you to think that if you just spend $3,000, you're on your way to making your record because you bought the equipment. This sort of unseen, disappearing player in all the records being made today is collaboration between artists and engineers and producers and studio musicians and all those people.
People who probably won't fit in your bedroom anyway. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
And you can find all of our coverage of music in the past decade at nprmusic.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The Orient Express. Very name carries an aura of glamour and mystery. Van Helsing wrote it to his battle with Dracula. James Bond romanced a beautiful Russian aboard it. And Agatha Christie set one of the best-known murders in literary history aboard that train. Now the original Orient Express is itself about to become a part of history. On Monday, the route will disappear from European railway timetables, victim of high-speed trains and cut-rate airlines. Rick Steves joins us now. He's the host of the popular PBS travel show that bears his name and the author of dozens of books on European travel. He joins us from his office in Edmonds, Washington. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
And how did the Orient Express gain this mystique?
Well, first of all, we should clarify there's two Orient Expresses. Probably the one people think about is a sort of nostalgic tour company that renovates 1930s-era cars and takes people from London to Venice. But the historic Orient Express, that's the one that was established back in the 1880s that took you from Paris or London to Istanbul.
And of course, it was always more kind of mysterious than luxurious, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's the luxury was probably back in the 1930s when they had, you know, the train itself was four sleeper cars and then one luggage car. But in practice, the Orient Express is the practical way you get across the Balkans. And back in the Cold War, you were dealing with Yugoslavia and Bulgaria and barking dogs. And I remember everybody with a briefcase looked mysterious to me. Anybody with an overcoat, what's under that overcoat? And, of course, it was this mystique of going east.
So you encountered a lot of beautiful Russian spies on the train?
No, I encountered a lot of scruffy people that looked sleazy. I remember corrupt conductors. I mean, you'd have to bribe your way to get across a border or to get your seat. And I remember literally sleeping in the hallways of those trains with peasants coming on and off. I mean, it was a vivid, ever-changing world, and it was the best easy accessible adventure to get on that Orient Express. And after this month, that name, which has been there for since 1883, will no longer be in the European train timetables.
Any murders ever occur when you were there?
Not when I was there, but in 1929, apparently the Orient Express was stuck in a snowstorm about 70 miles outside of Istanbul, and there was a murder, and that's what inspired Agatha Christie. And Agatha Christie actually went to Istanbul while she was writing that. I think the fact that it's in, you know, it's in Dracula, in James Bond, in Agatha Christie books and movies, and the nostalgia that a lot of travelers have for the good old days of train travel when you'd get on a two-day train ride. I mean, many people remember spending 2 days on the train to get from Paris to Turkey.
Now you can make that same trip for under $40 on a budget European airline.
Well, that's the amazing thing. I mean, kids are flying off to another country just to have lunch with their friends. And the glamour and class of train travel has changed quite a bit. And travel buffs and train buffs really lament the passing of the good old days of train travel. Every year there are fewer overnight trains and fewer elegant overnight trains. And this is just one more loss in that way as we morph into a more modern and more modern and affluent world.
Rick Steves, author of the Rick Steves Europe books and host of Travel with Rick Steves. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you, Scott.
And you can see the Orient Express chug elegantly through the years in a photo gallery on our website, npr.org.
It's been 40 years since the invention of what we now know as the Internet. And over the last few weeks, we've been exploring the people and ideas behind the network. It's our series, The Net at 40. Now, when you type in a web address, say my personal favorite, npr.org, you should thank a man named Paul Makapetris for making it all so easy. Dr. Makapetris developed a system that associates a string of numbers with a name. For instance, the IP address of npr.org is this, 216.35.221.77. You can type either one into your internet browser and get NPR's website. But it's much easier to remember npr.org. It's called DNS, the Domain Name System, and Dr. Makapetris joins me from Paris. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Makapetris, how did you come up with this idea? I mean, were you asked to do it?
I was actually given the job of taking five different proposals and harmonizing them together, and nobody noticed that I did something completely different.
When was this?
The system was first used in 1983 and I think was in production use in about 1986 or so. In the early days, we had a lot of freedom to experiment with it, so the system was recognizable as we know it in 83.
And before that, you had worked on something called the ARPANET, which we've talked about on this program, this sort of computer-to-computer network, the first computer-to-computer network that was created at the Pentagon in the late 60s.
You know, I tend to think of that as sort of the dinosaur age, and 1983 was the year that we had a big change over to IP, TCP, and DNS, and all of these new protocols. It was sort of the start of mammals on the internet. It was a very heady time because people basically took the experience they had of the ARPANET and just completely redid everything with a clean sheet of paper.
So until that point, if you wanted to communicate with another computer, you had to be part of the same network. It was almost as if you spoke English, you could only speak to other English speakers. The internet enabled people who spoke several different languages to communicate.
Or another way to think about it is that it might be the difference between different airlines and buses and boats and so forth. With the internet, you can get up, take the first part of your communication over a wireless network like the bus, and then you can go to an airport and get on a long-haul network and then get off and take a train at the other end. The whole idea is it made all of these different ways of transporting data work just as we would expect you to be able to take a trip on a conventional transport system.
And because of those changes, you had to come up with this domain name system, right?
Well, everybody that wants to play on the network, whether it's to have an email address or to connect a computer, needs a name for that. And I foresaw at the time that there might be 50 million of those one day. And so we designed to meet that goal, or at least that's the goal that I had in mind when I did it. Now, today things have grown to probably several billion different names. Because remember, it's not just machines. It's also individual email addresses or any of the identifiers.
So will we reach a point when it's saturated, when the system that you created can no longer handle the amount of names?
Well, if you think of sort of geography, there's only so much beachfront land that you can find, but there's an awful lot of addresses still. The same thing is true with domain names. Some people argue that the ones that they really want are already taken, but if you're willing to settle for a second or third choice, there's probably more domain names than there are people on Earth, phone numbers, automobiles, and pets put together.
Do you remember the first domain name that you made?
Well, I was doing the work at ISI, so I'm sure it was isi.edu. That was part of the University of Southern California.
And was there a number attached to that?
100052, I believe.
So do you get a cut every time someone registers a domain name?
A friend of mine said I was smart enough to invent the DNS, but not smart enough to own it.
That's Dr. Paul Makapetris. He's the inventor of the Domain Name System, or DNS. He joined us from Paris. You can listen to and read more from our series, The Net at 40, by typing in our domain name. That's npr.org. Dr. Makapetris, thanks for joining us.
Happy to do so.